All right, so practicalities. And I think our best guy in this respect is probably, well, the Buddha was a practical teacher, I think, and Heraclitus was a bit of a grumpy, leave me alone type. Uncle Lao was a bit grumpy, but he was a very practical bloke. And, all right, so I'm kind of saying that there's a meditative insight into self, which we realise the self is it's kind of empty, you know, and I keep saying that this void, this chaos, if you like, is another way of talking about this primal void of chaos, which is constantly producing cosmos or order, which is constantly degenerating into chaos, which is the primeval void. So form and void are always in this kind of interplay. They interpenetrate each other. In fact, they are mutually dependent opposites, which we need for the convenience of talking. But in fact, what's behind that is just a oneness, chaos and cosmos, form and void. And that ourselves are a part of that dance, what we take to be ourselves. So in the ordinary sense, they're insubstantial, they're not things. There's process going on, there's particularity, there's an organism and all the rest of it. But we're not things, as we think, as we inculcate it to believe about ourselves. And that there is some beatitude in seeing through that, through just realising it as a cognition, as a liberating cognition. Anyway, but you know, it all sounds like very, very high flown and strange and austere, but it's actually very practical. All this stuff, for all the kind of rarefied areas we've been into, it's practical. And Lao Tzu is really great at the side of all this, I think, despite being a grumpy old git. Anyway, this is one. I've selected this one. But I also have managed to mistype the thing. Anyway, this is great anyway. The Tao, which is that which is even before the One, it's the mother of all things, which is nevertheless empty. The Tao pours out everything into life. It is a cornucopia that never runs dry. It is the deep source of everything. It is nothing and yet in everything. It smooths round sharpness and untangles the knots. It glows like the lamp that draws the moth. Tao exists, Tao is, but where it came from I do not know. It has been shaping things from the very first, from before the first being, from the before the beginning of time. So you get a sense of the fecundity of it, you know? Which is what I want to keep saying to you, that you can avail yourself of this stuff at some very practical level.
And the mystery of it.
And yeah,
it leads to that, doesn't it?
Yeah. Mm. Well, it always remains mysterious, and the deeper you penetrate the mystery, the more there is. You always think about twitching the veil. It is veil upon veil upon veil, you know, but not really. And I mean, yeah, essentially mysterious, because you move beyond. You move underneath language, you move into the silence which language sits upon. So it's a gestalt switch again, it's a duck instead of a rabbit.
Mm.
It's the space instead of the lions, it's the silence instead of the words. You know, just as a gestalt switch to inform yourself. All right, this is about the use of emptiness, this one. 30 spokes on a cartwheel go towards the hub that is the centre. But look, there is nothing at the centre. And that is precisely why it works. If you mould a cup, you have to make a hollow. It is the emptiness within it that makes it useful. In a house or a room, it is the empty spaces, the doors, the windows, that make it usable. They all use what they are made of to do what they do, but without their nothingness, they would be nothing. So there's a kind of practicality of the use of emptiness, you know, and it's obviously part. It's very practical and concrete what he's talking about: houses, cups, cartwheels. But it's also to do metaphorical, also to that kind of light touch with yourself, which is you don't have to obliterate the self. Just have a light touch with the self and the dramas and the soap operas of the self. Just a light touch, and then that emptiness is available
as really useful, yeah.
as a fecund, pregnant something or nothing.
We're conditioned towards the stuff, aren't we?
Yep, it's the stuff all the way. Yeah. And I've put here, chapter, I've put it, be quiet, flow like water around obstacles without violence, let it be, but with bright awareness and with great depth in the heart. That's me paraphrasing, actually. I mean, how he puts it quite nicely. Here he says, the sage's way, or the way of Tao, is the way of water. There must be water for life to be, and it can flow wherever. And water being true to being water is true to Tao. Those on the way of Tao, like water, need to accept where they find themselves. And that may often be where water goes, to the lowest places, and that is right. Like a lake, the heart must be calm and quiet, having great depth beneath it. The sage rules with compassion, and his words need to be trusted. The sage needs to know, like water, how to flow around the blocks, and how to find the way through without violence. Like water, the sage should wait for the moment to ripen and be right. Water, you know, never fights. It flows around without harm. So it's like deeply strategy for living, you know. Actually, what's the point of going head banging your head all the time? Be skillful. Just flow around so that, let it just flow around, you know. So again, immensely practical. And all, if you have shit in meditation, and people don't people think you sit and that's it, it's beatific stuff straight away. No, but you're very likely, because you take the lid off the pressure cooker a little bit, some of this kind of suppressed shit comes up. In other words, meditation can be quite painful, quite difficult, quite challenging. That's how you deal with it.
Mm.
It's not like meeting it head on, trying to cultivate yourself, make yourself a better person, saying, oh, well, I shouldn't have, I'll have therapy for this. And no, it's about just having this flexible and fluid commitment, I suppose, commitment to some kind of fluidity. And you only have to kind of find how well that works once for it to become second nature, I would say. You don't have to have a great training in that. You just go, oh, bloody hell, yeah. Oh, this is cool.
Yeah.
And it's a simple realisation.
That's lovely.
It's available to you. It's good, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah, because then it's a management, really.
Yeah. It's a little bit, it's a practicality that's not actually a cultivation, though.
You know what to do with it, then.
That's it, yeah. And so you then also, if you get your head around that, you don't have to be put off by any heavy shit that you encounter, you know.
Yeah. You trust that it's going to flow.
Yeah.
Instead of grass.
But I still think you can do that, and you can go through the heavy shit, if you know what I mean, and it's not that easy, and then it's all easy afterwards, and something bad can happen, and all of a sudden the heavy shit comes back, and it's not so easy to...
Yeah. Linear progress in any kind of sense, you know. Well,
but you think you'd be able to deal with it again, wouldn't you?
I think it's going to vary with individuals, you know. But
yeah.
I don't think it's that hard either. I keep saying it about this stuff. It's elusive. It's not difficult.
Mm.
It is a bit of a fine knife edge, you know. It's very easy to slip into cultivating because of resistances, but it's also easy to slip into like some kind of total soporific laziness and thinking that that's it. It's a bit of a very subtle knife edge, which is what makes it a bit elusive. But it's not difficult in the sense of like running a mile in under 4 minutes.
No.
So any of us can do what I'm talking about. You know, but none of us is ever going to run a mile in under 4 minutes.
Mm.
I'm sorry, but you know, because that's difficult. That's difficult. This isn't difficult, but it's very, very subtle.
And having no expectations that result is permanent.
Yeah.
Exactly.
No expectations at all.
Yeah,
at all.
Yeah.
You can't have
the
gentle
realm
rules.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, they say you don't do this, you're not supposed to do this. Do it, but you know, if it don't suit you, change it a little bit to organize it for yourself. I mean, I always found that when I was doing very severe meditations, I always found I'd do something silly like take a Terry Pratchett book, and I'd take my head off it, and I'd read a really fun chapter or something, or I'd listen to some nice music, I'd break the rule, you know, suppose. That was great.
A nice thing.
Yeah.
So it's finding the way.
But don't do, I used to do it deliberately because I used to find that it got too heavy. So I deliberately break the rules before I got there. Surely everybody's not the same.
No.
No, they're not. You don't know what to expect, really.
No.
Would you describe it as a passive process? You were talking about sort of that moving around, the water moving around. Mm. Is it passive, or what would you...
Yeah, it's a bit of both. It's to an extent, it's deliberately reacting to situations you know are going to occur within you.
Right. Mm.
So you are actually knowing yourself before, and you know the problems that you are going to encounter.
Mm.
So you, around those, you...
It's a navigation.
So it can be based on practice as well?
Yeah. But it can be much more rapid than that, though.
Yeah, you do have to be very, very clear about this, there's a difference between the recommendations that you're going to get from so-called spiritual teachers that fall into two types, and I keep saying it because it's so crucial, between exploration, inquiry on the one hand, and cultivation on the other hand. Cultivation for whatever reason, whether you want to suffer less, be better, be more morally perfect, all of that, it's a completely different agenda from finding out.
Exploration.
Exploration. And an exploration, or experiment, you might say, requires sensitivity.
Mm.
Cultivation desensitizes.
Mm.
It desensitizes you.
You're expecting stuff.
No.
Because you said, everybody's different.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah.
You.
Yeah. And I'd even go as far as to say that any kind of cultivation is violent. An experiment requires. Exploration requires that you become sensitive, otherwise you're not going to see. It's no good going to the Amazon jungle in a blindfold. You need to have your eyes open, and that's the sensitivity of having your eyes open comes out of being non-violent with yourself.
Yeah.
Non-violent, all this talk about ahimsa, actually, non-violence towards oneself produces the sensitivity that enables you to explore. And inquire and find out for yourself, really for yourself, instead of being a second-hand person who's operating somebody else's cultivation program that they've dreamed up for their own nefarious reasons.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is such a stark difference that I can't hammer it home enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's
it is very much a letting be. In fact, Wu Wei, our friend Lao Tzu has a name for it, Wu Wei. Wu-wei, which means, non-doing. Where have I put it? I think chapter 11's got something about that. Let me have a look. That's the one about the spokes on the wheel, yeah. The usefulness of emptiness, But anyway, there's a couple of other things, and then I'll read you. I'll go back to the pub. It's getting on as well, so... I mentioned Logos before, which I say is, this is Heraclitus thing, Logos, the intelligence of things. This is the ordering, the harmonious ordering of existence, which we call cosmos, that exists in this mutually dependent relationship with chaos, the formless void, the primordial void, and that the whole of existence is the dance and the play between those two who are ineluctably married together. Logos, the intelligence of things, and I put it like Patanjali's Ishvara, will show you the oneness and let you avail yourself of it. It's practical as well. You can avail yourself of this kind of deeper intelligence, but it comes out of getting out of the way. You have to let it express itself, because it's not your IQ or your ego or your customary ways of doing stuff or how well you've learned from experience. It's not that. It's this kind of using the flow of things, using the grain of things to express and exert will even in life. Yeah, so it's kind of practical as well as giving us this kind of cognitive insight that's liberatory. It's very liberatory to know that you contain the intelligence of the universe. the cells of your body contain it. Your brain is operating on the same laws once we get down to the molecular level that everything else is operating on.
Because we are it, really.
We are it. We are it. You know, so. And this is just one boundary amongst many. One in a swirling pattern of lines. Boundaries are just lines in the field of existence. So, but they're swirling. It's like if you try this thing of putting some ink into milk or something, and so it goes. That's what existence is. It's a kind of a living Rorschach blot, you know.
So is it your instinct? Is that another topic?
It's another topic because we generally reserve instincts for things like you know, wanting to mate, wanting to eat, wanting to, and but at the same time it's related to instinct in as much as it's embedded in our animality. It's not like it's a kind of rarefied thing. It's actually right down in the animality and the fleshy, gritty, down to earth blood clot of life.
Down to
you know,
conditioning.
Hey?
Down to your conditioning, the way your mind even operates. It goes that far down.
It goes down farther than that, even probably.
Evolutionary survival type things.
Yeah, it is deeper. Yeah.
Well, I think of the instances when historically our ancestors might have used Wu Wei or Ishvara Pranidhana, you know. It would have been, I've talked about this with you before, you know, the state of mind of a guy standing on a rock with a spear, perfectly motionless and totally concentrated on what's happening in the water, even though concentrating very easeful, an easeful, natural, loose concentration, waiting for the fish, and gets the fish, because that's dinner. This is serious business. Getting dinner is serious business. And he operates on that level of the intelligence of things. Obviously, the more he does it, the better he gets at it. But basically, it's coming from some kind of very deep reflexive level, you know. And these are the best examples of that. Actually, it's things like combat. You know, it's often come back to like jiu-jitsu or aikido or something where there's this. You don't think about it. If you think about it, you're going to get clobbered. You don't think about it. It's faster than thought. Or the ox, the guy chopping up the ox in the Changsu. We must do that again because it's just wonderful. But you ask him how he does it, he says, I don't know how I do it. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I do it. I just go with the grain and he doesn't try and he doesn't need to sharpen his thing because he's just in the grain of the meat. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like. Anyway, I've got another couple of things here and I think then that will probably do that bit. I did want to mention the flower sermon. There's a famous incident in the Buddha's life when it was time for him to give his afternoon discourse because he kind of talked to the disciples in the afternoons. And this one time he goes in to the place, sits on the little platform, he's got a little white flower in his hand and he just stares at the flower and smiles. And all the disciples go, what the fuck's he on now, you know? But there's one guy, it's a guy called Mahakashyap, smiles. Just the one guy smiles, Mahakashyap smiles. And the Buddha says of him, says, well, he got it. I empower this Mahakashyap to now take the message forward. And Mahakashyap become the first patriarch of Zen. And it's the idea of a transmission just through the smile itself, you know. And again, that's the practicality of very little, you know, of doing very little. No great elaborate explanation, just the flower and the smile was enough, you know. It was enough. And what does that say about elaborate? Mahakashyap became full-on enlightened in that moment. Then the smile, when he smiled, the Buddha saw him smile and recognised that, he's got it. He's got it, great, he's got it. So where is all your elaborate meditation with your chakras and your visualise and your moral perfection and trying to counteract your kind of animal bestiality and bottling up your sperm and da 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 and all the whole kind of the whole bullshit Now, all bullshit, when what did it take for Mark Kashyap to get enlightened was for the Buddha to smile at a flower and for him to kind of see what was going on. See, against seeing, you know. So, I'm kind of telling you that story to vindicate my own minimalist approach, obviously. Because don't do anything in all that, you know. Let it be.
Because going to other yoga classes made me realise just the massive difference.
Yeah.
You know, like with that minimalist.
Yeah.
And then others, even though they're great, but they're too busy. Well, too busy for me.
Yeah.
But perhaps that's because I've always come in, you know, sort of
thing. Yeah, well, once I infect you.
And it's almost as if... What did you say?
I said, once I infect you, you've kind of had it. Yeah. But, I'm ruining people for everybody else.
But it's almost as if... You made me forget what I was saying.
Sorry. I shouldn't have said the word... Was it the word infect that kind of caused the problem?
Oh, yeah. What I was going to say was, with the other type of yoga teaching which I've experienced... There isn't an allowing of yoga to do you. You wouldn't end up with yoga doing you. You would always be doing it.
Yeah.
That was my conclusion, or a countering. So I thought I'd rather...
Yeah, let the yoga do you, or the meditation, or whatever you want.
Simple approach. But you've got to go to the others to find out, haven't you?
You should go.
You don't find out, really, do you? You know.
You know when it feels...
I do warn you.
Yeah. But you have to find out for yourself.
You've got to find out for yourself.
I sent my class to him to see it, said they got him. But he'd come back though. During the old ones.
Oops. Jim's out the same mold.
They're all the same.
Yeah. They're not going to be the same, even if everybody was.
I do agree. Most yoga teachers don't understand what yoga's about.
Yeah.
All right, I want to just have one other practical thing, and this is about the flow. I suppose it's the recommendation: go with the flow as your methodology, as your very, very minimal methodology. I'm talking about kind of going with the flow. You know, and our friend Uncle Lau, the grumpy old uncle, he recommends. Water and flowing. I think this was quite a good. Have I got the right one? Yeah, maybe not. I keep looking at my references here, you know, and they're kind of. I've got my paraphrase there and the references, and they don't bear any resemblance to it. But never mind, this is still good. Understand the thrust of the yang, that's the male, thrust, be more like the yin in your being. Be like a valley that parts to its stream. Be like a stream for the earth and channel it so it flows to the sea. Be newborn, be free of yourself, be humble, be earthy, be a valley for the whole world. Be a channel for the energies here. Weave them in a true and practical way so they link up with the way and become one again. Oneness generates everything. When the sage rules in the light of it, he rules everything. A wise man never tries to break up the whole. I was going to do that, talk about that thing. Oh, yeah, actually, it's here. That's why it's thinking. It should have been 60. Anyway, this is, again, water. Flowing nature of water. Oh, okay, we've had the flame. That's useful. But water's also useful. All right. Nothing in the world is softer than water. But we know it can wear away the hardest of things. The supple overcomes the hard, and the so-called weak, the strong. People know this, but no one quite believes it. The sage always shoulders the blame and the grief. That is why he is fit to rule. He takes on his nation like a world, as if it was the world, and so it is. And the truth is that the truth is often a paradox. So, the water thing is what I wanted to draw your attention to there, you know, that kind of flowing thing that he's recommending. Anyway, meanwhile, back at the pub. At Dinas Deviniad, the city of the magicians, our friend Tavis has just texted his girlfriend. Anyway, this big text comes back and she says, nice try. Big boy, not good enough. Anyway, so by now they're kind of steaming drunk, the three of them, and somebody says to Buddha, "We heard that you prescribed intoxicants." He does actually. He says, "You know, don't intoxicate too much," and the monks are not allowed to have any kind of intoxicants. So I think what's his name? Heraclitus, being a bit of a grump, he says, "You're not supposed to drink. You're telling all your disciples not to drink, and look at you, as pissed as a fart. Not only that, there's mushrooms and all sorts of stuff in this beer. You're completely off your face." And the Buddha says, "Oh, well, that's just what I tell them." And there is a story about some guy. This is kind of an Indian story, and I'm going to paraphrase it, and I don't, I can't remember exactly where it comes from, but it is an ancient story. But there was some guy meditating in the woods, and he was there years and years and years, and just getting more and more and more frustrated, because he just still felt like dukkha. He still had a bit of grit in his axle hole, you know. Not enough lubricant. So, and he's getting really, really cheesed off. And the one guy, he kind of cries out, you know, says, "I'm fucking fed up with this. I'm just a clog every day, 8 hours a day meditating, and I still feel like a piece of shit." And one of the gods appeared to him and says, look, man, look, how can I help you? Because I can tell you're desperate. And he says, "Show me Buddha's paradise so I can kind of be reassured that I'm not wasting my life sitting under this tree, staring at the back of my eyelids and bringing my kundalini into me here, there and everywhere." You know, and the guy says, "Oh, all right then." And he kind of does a magic thing on him. He says, "Oh, abracadabra." Taps him on the forehead. And the guy, the ascetic, he's immediately transported to the Buddha's heaven. And in the Buddha's heaven, you know, the Buddha's sitting in the corner, slumped in an armchair, and his eyes are all red. And there's like a bottle of Jack Daniels has kind of fell down by the side of the chair, lying on the floor, and an opium pipe, and God knows what, and all these kind of concubines, you know, and he's like deeply, deeply appalled and shocked, you know, and the Buddha says, "Well, what do you think we do up here all day?" Anyway. I haven't made that up. That is like a traditional, really? Traditional story that tries to kind of do a bit of a tantry blower on it. Anyway. So the Buddha tells that story to Heraclitus in the pub, and Heraclitus goes, "All right then, a dry soul is best." "A dry soul is best." And then. Anyway, obviously they all got their own little takes on this. Anyway, Taliesin in there, he's sitting there kind of scratching his head, and he goes, "Eureka!" He says, "I've got it, lads, I've got it. Tell me what you think of this before I send it." And he gets his phone out, he's got it on his phone, and he says, this is for the high priestess, and she's definitely going to marry me, and she is this. Right, this is what he's going to say. "Everything moves, my darling, your heart and mine for you, like Heraclitus's fire and the water beloved of Uncle Lau, deliciously rippling, and the wind's pure music and the swirling world of Prince Buddha over there. Come then, won't you, to my breast? I've studied with drunken sages. No one is more ready."
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, thanks for coming.
What did she say?
I'll leave you with that one. Any questions? If you might have said, "Nice try, big boy." By the way,
she might have been seduced by that.
I think at least curious.
Yeah, by the way, I've been seeing Cledwyn from. From the sheep farm, you know.
Cledwyn.
He's the guy with the green wellies, you know. So.
Studied with drunken sages.
Yeah. I've studied with drunken sages, sir.
I like that.
Anyway, any questions? It's, I warn you, it's 25 to 5, by the way.
You must have something to say.